Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
The case of Fernando Bay Sosa. Hello, everyone. Three times a week on this channel, we will bring you the crimes that have impacted the entire world, from disappearances to the most terrible murders, injustice, impunity, corruption, and the harshest sentences will accompany these stories. Before starting the story, I ask that you subscribe and activate the bell with all notifications. Also, don't forget to leave a like, as that way I will be able to continue creating content. Without further ado, let's analyze together all the details of this criminal story. Fernando José Bay Sosa was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, on March 2, 2001. He was the only child of the marriage formed by Silvino Baez and Graciela Sosa, Paraguayan immigrants. Silvino got a job as a doorman, equivalent to the position of a concierge in other countries, in a building in the affluent neighborhood of Recoleta, and as part of his employment agreement he was entitled to housing there. There, he and Graciela, who earned her living as a caregiver for the elderly, lived with Fernando. Fernando was a good student from a young age. He attended the Marianist school in Caballito as a scholarship student because his family could not afford the monthly tuition. Caballito is a neighborhood located some distance from Recoleta, and on some occasions his mother would tell Fernando to transfer to a closer school, but he refused. He enjoyed the Christian education he received and the extracurricular activities that fostered solidarity. He finished his secondary studies at that institution. It was at that school that he met Julieta Rossi. They were not in the same class, but they had mutual friends. In February 2018, they participated in the Server Project, through which Marianist students carry out masonry work in a social organization that requires it. Little by little, the young people began to establish a relationship. On their graduation trip, they shared their first kiss at a party venue, but it wasn't until March 2019 that the couple took it to the next level. On the chosen day, Fernando accompanied Julieta to her tango class. Then they went to see a movie at the Baez house. And when Fernando finally proposed to her, Julieta said yes. They hugged and both cried with emotion. That was Fernando, a sweet, polite, and respectful boy, with enormous sensitivity. The young man had a good nature and made friends wherever he went. When he turned 18, his parents couldn't afford to pay for a party at a venue. But Fernando didn't worry. He met up in a square with his friends from elementary school, high school, the volleyball team, and the neighborhood. He used to spend a lot of time with his group of friends who considered him an excellent person and a key part of every outing due to his good nature and willingness to have fun in a healthy way. They kept each other company and took care of each other. Julieta and Fernando started the basic cycle together to enter the law program at the University of Buenos Aires. They were a great team, they made a good duo. She took the notes and he summarized the books. Fernando had passed all the CBC subjects that qualified him to enroll in the law program. The night he had to take the last subject, he did not sleep. On his way home, with a passing grade on his notebook, he fell asleep on the bus and his cell phone was stolen. When he got home, he told his mother that he had good news and bad news. Graciela asked him to start with the good news, and he told her that he had been able to enter the program he wanted. His mother jumped up from her chair and hugged him. The bad news was that he no longer had a phone, but Graciela told him that it did not matter, that she would buy him another one. She loved her son and was proud of what a good boy he was. Fernando had to graduate as a lawyer as soon as possible. He said he wanted to work so his parents would stop working and that it would be his way of repaying them for the effort they had always made for him. Fernando threw his notebook to Silvino. The father said that the day he entered law school, his son was so happy that he threw his grades on Silvino's chest while laughingly telling him that he had made it despite his father's lack of faith in him. But they both knew that wasn't true. Silvino believed in his son, but he was demanding with him because he feared that with so many temptations and dangers on the street, his boy would lose his way. Like all boys his age, Fernando, 18, was eager for summer to arrive so he could have fun. That's how he arrived in Villa Gesell on Thursday, January 16, 2020, along with his high school friends and his girlfriend Julieta. They stayed at the Ola Hostel, where they planned to stay until January 23rd. Around 7 p.m. on Friday, January 17th, Fernando, Julieta, and his friends decided to go to the Labrique nightclub, located in the town of Balneária, where they arrived at 1:45 a.m. on Saturday, January 18th. The group consisted of Fernando, Lucas Feraldi, Julian Garcia, Federico Tavarozzi, Lucas Vejide, Juan Bautista Besuzzo, and Santiago Corbo. Julieta was with two or three other friends. They entered the club together. Shortly after, their lives would change forever. There was another group of friends who had also decided to go out partying. This other group was made up of guys from the Buenos Aires city of Cerati, aged between 18 and 20 at that time in 2020. And most of them belonged to the rugby team of the Arsenal Nautical Club of that city. They were Maximo Thompson, Enzo Cumley, Matias Benicelli, Luciano Pertosi, Ciro Pertosi, Eitan Bioaz, Blas Sin Sei, and Lucas Pertosi, along with others. All of them are protagonists of our story, so we will give you a brief presentation of each one with data up to 2023. Maximo Thompson, 23 years old, was born on November 27, 1999. His relatives nickname him Machu. He is the youngest son of Marcial Javier Thompson, 56 years old, who is dedicated to the trade of articles and accessories for vehicles, cars and motorcycles. And Rosalia Cerati, former Secretary of Public Works for the Municipality of Cerati and an architect. Marcial and Rosalia. They divorced many years before. Maximo trained as a rugby player at Arsenal Cerati Rugby and had been playing for Club Atletico San Isidro in Buenos Aires since 2017. He was a student at the Physical Education Teaching School and wanted to be a high-performance kinesiologist. Ciro Pertosi, 22, was born on May 8, 2000. He was studying for a CBC in architecture at the University of Buenos Aires. He is the brother of Luciano Pertosi and the cousin of Lucas. His father is Mauro Pertosi, a production supervisor for the multinational automotive company Toyota. No information is known about his mother. Lucas Pertosi, 23, was born on February 25, 1999. The son of Marcos Pertosi and the cousin of Ciro and Luciano. No further personal information is available about him. Luciano Pertosi, 22, was born on January 29, 2001, into the Pertosi family. He is Ciro's brother and is known as Chano. He had not finished high school, but he wanted to study engineering and surveying. Matias Benicelli, 23, was born on November 5, 1999, and is the son of Hector Eduardo Benicelli, who had a paint shop. Eno Cumley, 23, was born on February 25, 2000, and is the son of Maria Alejandra Gillian. The name of his father, who works in the hardware business, is unknown. Blast Sanayi, 21, was born on April 18, 2001, and is the son of Maria Paula. No further information is available about his family. Antonio, 23, was born on May 9, 1999, and is the son of Erica Pizzati. This group of rugby players who went out partying in Villa Gesell also included Juan Pedro Guarino, Aleio Milanese, and Tomas Collazo, whose personal details were not obtained. Now that we've told you who the protagonists are, we'll continue with the story of the day when everyone's destinies crossed paths. And it wasn't for the best. At 4:30 a.m. on February 18th, due to the crowds at the Labrique nightclub, there was a clash between the rugby players and Fernando's friends. One of the young men from Cerati angrily demanded that they stop pushing, to which Fernando's friend replied that they were all the same. That was enough to inflame things. Then the rugby players incited the other group to fight and they had an initial skirmish inside the club. The Labrique security guards decided to take out the rugby players who were putting up resistance, especially Maximo, who was very upset. They made them retreat through the emergency exit. On the other hand, Fernando and his friends agreed to leave peacefully and were allowed to exit through the front of the nightclub. After being thrown out, Fernando decided to stay in front of the nightclub. It should not be forgotten that Julieta was inside the club with her friends and he would not go anywhere without his girl. He sat with some of his friends eating ice cream and waiting for the rest of the group to come out. At that moment, the police were on that street. The rugby players were looking for revenge, but decided to walk around the block due to the police presence. Then, the officers received a call and moved to another location. A few minutes later, this could have changed the tragic outcome. When the police left at 4:44 a.m., Enzo and Ciro attacked Fernando and his friends from behind. In fact, Fernando was thrown to the ground in that treacherous attack. It is believed that 8 of the 10 people from Zarate participated in the beating. Lucas filmed the beginning of the beating until he stopped recording to join in throwing punches. The perpetrators beat Fernando until he was unconscious. When Fernando was already on the ground, Maximo kicked him in the head and punched him. Other members of the group also beat up Fernando's friends, who tried to get closer to help him because he was defenseless against the pack attack. A friend of Fernando's, Tomas, was also injured. The attack lasted less than a minute and the aggressors withdrew from the scene. The people who witnessed the attack immediately approached Fernando, who was lying unconscious on the ground. A girl performed CPR on him, but it was in vain. He was already dead. At 4:45 a.m., two rugby players were seen hugging each other, apparently in celebration, in front of the Cipriani restaurant, a few meters from where Fernando had lost his life. A few minutes later, the police intercepted Ciro, Eno, Matias, Juan, and Luciano in front of the Marina supermarket. At that moment, Ciro licked his fingers, a last-minute maneuver so that it would not be noticeable that they were stained with Fernando's blood. The group managed to evade the agents. At that same location, a woman, Andrea Rano, manager of the Inti Wasi hostel, a few meters from Labrique, saw a group of young people pass by the Marina supermarket and heard one of them say, "I covered his face in blood." At 4:52, Lucas Bertosi returned to where Fernando was dying. At 4:55, he sent a voice message from the scene. Friends, I'm here near where the foot is and there's everyone screaming, "The police are here, call an ambulance." The coldness with which he referred to Fernando's death had worn off. It would be the same that he and his friends would show from then on. Lucas sent another message moments later, complaining that he was looking for Ciro and couldn't find him. He tells me, "Come to the market that we always pass. I'm at the market around the corner from the hotel and my friend isn't here. It's more like Lolo, this Ciro." Quote. From that moment on, there were different exchanges via WhatsApp between the rugbyers and their friends that later allowed us to learn about the actions of the aggressors and their way of thinking about the events. Blast was the one who reported the most on what happened via WhatsApp. The most relevant messages were the following. "They took out all the bouncers. We beat them up really, really badly. They grabbed us all by the neck, they took us all outside, the police and gendarmerie grabbed us. We won anyway." Blast himself said in another message that we're arriving at McDonald's. "Let's go back to the center to see what's up, maybe we'll run into them." Referring to wanting to continue the fight with Fernando's friends, he continued in an agitated voice. "Send me some real news. We're running so they don't see us." He continued in another conversation. "We fought, we won against some chetos, we broke them, we're leaving. To the center to reward." Cheto is a derogatory word used in Argentina, in the youth vocabulary to name those who do not belong to their urban tribe. Then he bragged. "There was a blonde guy who was grabbing my ankle." He was referring to Thomas de Alessandro, a friend of Fernando who grabbed his ankles trying to stop the attack. Around 5:30 a.m., two of the rugby players went to eat at a fast food place located 3 blocks from La Brie. They were Lucas and Maximo. Both had changed their clothes, so it is assumed that they had previously gone to the place where they were staying to put on clothes that did not have traces of the fight. It was thought that other members of the group could have gone to do the same, but this could not be confirmed. The chats continued throughout the night until the morning. At 6:47 someone asked him, "What's up, Blas? Did you guys fight?" Quote. Blast replied, "Two had convulsions. We sent one to the hospital with no vital signs." Minutes later, he explained, "We beat one of them up with the perto, we beat him up, but badly. We came running home." "Are you drunk, my friend?" Quote. Someone replied, "Yeah, my friend, since the afternoon," he replied. He was referring to the fact that he had been drinking liquor since the previous day. In another message to another contact unrelated to the case, Blast confessed, "Dude, we got mad. I think we killed one. Gessel is all saying that. In La Brique," quote. Faced with this, his interlocutor replied, "Eh, no, my friend, maybe he won't get up. And he passed out." Blast replied, "Dude, two different groups said they took him to the hospital with no vital signs. I don't even care," quote. "But we all went back home, we didn't want to go out." Far from worrying, the friend replied in a festive manner, "No, my friend, the demolition men." Minutes later, Blast's interlocutor confirms the murder. "Dude, we're here. Are you telling me they killed someone?" The rugby player's response is even more outrageous. "I just want to drink wine and smoke flowers." It's a reference to smoking marijuana. Later, at 6:37 a.m., Blast started another chat with a friend who was returning home, who admitted that they smoked a marijuana cigarette with cocaine and asked him if they had really fought. The rugby player replied, "Yeah, don't say I told you, because I don't know if he's heavy or not." Inside La Brique, Bondi painted, "They were a couple. We beat the crap out of him when the whole cap came out. The cops left and we gave him life for a while. Two convulsed and supposedly had no vital signs." After an inconsequential conversation about buying food, smoking marijuana and going to the beach the next day, the friend who was not in the fight responded to an audio from Blosh that alludes to Fernando's crime. "We won," says Blast. The others must have been punks. At 10:38 a.m., the Saratoga men were arrested by the Buenos Aires police. The officers identified and located them using security cameras from the nightclub, as well as from the fast food restaurant, and information provided by witnesses. Upon entering the home where they were all staying for the vacation, the police informed the group that they were accused of homicide. None of them were fazed by the situation until the officers found Maximo's sneaker stained with blood. While one officer waved the sneaker asking who it belonged to, Maximo mentioned Pablo Ventura, and the others backed him up, knowing full well that it was a lie. Pablo was a boy the defendants knew from the club, but he had a very different personality. He was very calm, had a small group of friends, and was not a troublemaker, but he did suffer bullying from the rugby team for several years, and this would be the most macabre act against him. The rugby players, when accusing Pablo, informed the police that he had left the city around 7 a.m. in a white car and gave a description that they knew matched the car of the young man's father. They also told the agents to hurry, as he was going to flee to Uruguay. They knew that Pablo and his family were going on vacation in Uruguay. The police began an intense search for Pablo until they found him more than 500 kilometers from Villa Gesell at his family home in Suratí. They took him into custody and the Ventura family's odyssey began. His desperate parents began gathering evidence about Pablo's whereabouts on the night of the murder. They knew he was innocent, but they needed to prove it. Fortunately for them, in the midst of their misfortune, that same night that Fernando was murdered, Pablo and his family had gone to eat at a restaurant. His family managed to gain access to the cameras and presented the videos as evidence, as well as chats on Pablo's cell phone, which clearly showed that he was aware of the situation in Villa Gesell the following morning. Friends of the young man also came forward as witnesses. Pablo spent 4 days in detention and was acquitted due to lack of evidence, but he was yet another victim of this group of young people willing to blame anyone else to avoid receiving the punishment they deserved. After being arrested after refusing to testify at the Villa Gesell prosecutor's office, five of the young men were transferred to Pinamar, while the rest remained in the seaside city. In the meantime, the first pieces of evidence began to be collected, such as videos filmed by witnesses and by security cameras from the nightclub and the street. All the evidence found in the house rented by the rugby players, such as clothing and shoes stained with blood, one pair of which belonged to Maximo, were subjected to various analyses. Regarding the shoes, they were sent for a scopometry test by the Tierra del Fuego police to verify whether their soles had hit Fernando's head. The young men's cell phones were confiscated and sent to a laboratory in Mar del Plata for expert examination. The main witnesses, including Fernando's friends, also testified. The results of the autopsy were also released, indicating that the victim had died from neurogenic shock caused by internal bleeding from multiple blows. As a result of this result, it was not possible to determine who delivered the fatal blow. In the following weeks, lineups were held to accurately determine the role of each of the attackers, in which all of them were identified, except for Alejo. When the investigation began, the most important thing, given the number of people involved, was to establish the roles of each person during the attack in order to determine specific responsibilities for the crimes committed. It was determined that the main participant in the crime was Maximo, who punched Fernando and kicked him in the head, at least twice, while he was already lying on the ground. He was filmed hitting and fleeing the scene of the crime erratically, according to witnesses. Asiro was seen attacking Fernando from behind in the video recorded by Lucas, punching him, in addition to being the one who knocked him down. The victim's blood was found on his clothes. Eno was also seen in Lucas' videos. He is one of the first attackers along with Chiro. Later, he is seen beating Fernando's companions. Blast appears in the videos hitting Tomas with punches and kicks. He had a secondary role until the results of the expert examination identified him as the aggressor in the murder. His genetic material was found in one of Fernando's fingernails. Matias is held responsible for haranguing Fernando and Tomas during the beating. A DNA test found the victim's blood on his shirt and shoe. Luciano took part in the fight inside the nightclub. His clothes were damaged. He and Aleio were thrown out through a different door than the rest of the defendants. He arrived late to the attack and was seen on video beating Fernando's friend, Tomas, until he was left lying on the hood of a car. The prosecutor found him beating his friends, although the victim's blood was later found on his shirt, confirming his participation in the murder. Lucas filmed the beginning of the attack and then joined in and was considered Tomas's aggressor. Eitan was the only one who did not have a cell phone at the time of his arrest. He had to sell it in order to travel with his friends. His role was that of a cheerleader. He is not shown beating Fernando or his friends. Despite this, he was very close to Maximo at the time of the beating. Juan was also with the group at the nightclub and at the time of their expulsion. During the attack, he could be seen standing with his arms crossed and a sweater draped over his shoulders, meters away from the bed. He waited for his friends and left the nightclub with them to the house they were renting. He sent a message to his girlfriend saying that he would return to Sade. He had seen different situations of violence before and had told her and her mother that if it happened again, he would leave. He was released due to lack of merit in the attack. Aleio is the only rugby player who was not recognized in the identification parade and was not located at the crime scene, but a case has now been opened against him for false testimony. Since he and Luciano were thrown out of the nightclub through another exit, it is believed that he never made it to the fight. He was seen waiting for the others and walking with Eitan to his accommodation. Like Juan, he was released due to lack of merit. Tomas was initially known as rugby player number 11, since he was a minor at the time of the murder and therefore his identity was preserved until the trial. He was friends with members of this group. He was with his parents in Villa Gesell and decided to go to the nightclub with his acquaintances. He was seen walking with the defendants to the house and there was a photo of him with the group. He was seen very close during the incident, but without taking any active role. He grabbed Maximo by the shoulder to stop him from hitting the victim. He has not been charged at this time. At first, there was talk of labeling the case as homicide in a fight, but as the days went by, the prosecutor charged them with homicide aggravated by the premeditated participation of two or more people, which led to a life sentence. Two of the detainees, Maximo and Chiro, were charged as co-perpetrators of the crime, while the other...
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
We were charged as necessary participants. They were then transferred to the Dolores prison. In the meantime, videos and WhatsApp messages continued to emerge that could better clarify the role of each person and what they did after the murder. On February 10, 2020, Prosecutor Veronica Samboni requested preventive detention for 8 of the 10 defendants, Maximo, Chiro, Lucas, Matias, Blast, Eno, Eitan, and Luciano. She also requested provisional release for Alejo and Juan due to the alleged lack of merit, since insufficient evidence was found to place them at the place and time of the attack on Fernando. However, they remained accused and released from prison. Days later, the judge requested a change of charge to double aggravated homicide due to premeditated participation of 2 or more people and treachery. This fact was questioned by the defense, since according to the lawyers, the judge must adhere to what was proposed by the prosecutor, otherwise the principle of consistency would be violated. Furthermore, these new charges were not communicated to those involved at the time of their arrest. The day before the massive march demanding justice for Fernando held on February 18, 2020, the prosecutor expanded the charge of co-authors to the 8 rugby players who remained in custody, with Alejo and Juan being released as necessary participants. On March 13, 2020, the young men from Ararat were transferred to the Melchor Romero prison, where they were placed in 2 cells for psychological testing, but the tests were suspended due to the health situation caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. The rugby players' lawyers requested that their clients be granted house arrest, but the Dolores Court of Appeals and Guarantees upheld the preventive detention of the 8 young men arrested in April 2020. It also maintained the charge of double aggravated homicide and supported the work of Prosecutor Sanoni. The only modification made by the Court of Appeals was that Maximo and Chiro were once again classified as co-authors and the other 6 detainees as necessary participants, while Alejo and Juan were not charged with participating in the incident and were later dismissed from the case. Finally, the oral trial began on January 2, 2023, in Criminal Court No. 1 of Dolores, in which more than 130 witnesses testified over 2.5 weeks. The prosecution was led by Dr. Fernando Berlanda, attorney Fabian Amendola, and his son Facundo Amendola, while the defense of the accused was led by Dr. Hugo Tamay and attorney Emilia Portosi, sister of the accused Chiro and Luciano. During the trial, the violence of the group of friends and Maximo's leadership came to light. They said that his rugby training helped the young man to be invincible in the street fights he took part in at dawn in Sarate. In fact, he and his friends had set up a WhatsApp group called Los Demoledores, which in 2019 left a young man seriously injured in the hospital. Neighbors the same age as the rugby players pointed out that everyone in Sarate knew that this gang went out looking for a fight. Sometimes they didn't even drink alcohol. They went out to fight, inspiring fear, and no one dared to confront them. They also said that Maximo wasn't the one looking for a fight. That was the job of the Portosi. But every time there were fights, Maximo would change and they couldn't stop him. They said that they especially started fights outside Absara, the trendy place in Sarate. Such was the physical rigor of this group that more than once, Maximo and some of his friends worked as security guards at that dance club. On January 3rd, Julieta, Fernando's girlfriend, and the friends who were with him during the terrible early morning of the events were scheduled to testify at the trial. However, Julieta was not in an emotional condition to testify. Her father, Oscar Rossi, spoke on her behalf, emphasizing that his daughter was the last person to leave the nightclub in Labrique. The bride's father recalled that summer he had gone on vacation to Pinamar and was traveling to Village Sol when he received a call from Julieta, who asked him to go with her because she was at the police station and Fernando was in the hospital. He said that since that early morning his daughter has been devastated and that she is still undergoing psychological treatment. He described Fernando as an incredible, extraordinary and very good human being. He referred to the painful moment he shared with the young man's parents on January 19, 2020, at the morgue to identify the body. He said that he did not wish what he saw on Fernando's body on anyone, because not even a hunter would do that to an animal. He also indicated that the investigating prosecutor, Veronica Samboni, who was then in charge of the case, explained to him what had happened and that his daughter asked him for a piece of clothing that she had in her hands and that Fernando had been wearing moments before for DNA testing. That was key evidence, because the genetic traces of that clothing were later compared with others that belonged to the rugby players involved. When Oscar's statement ended, 10 of Fernando's friends began to testify, all of them eyewitnesses to his death. One of them, Lucas Philippi, stated that the rugby players accused of murdering him surprised him with a blow that knocked him to the ground and he had no chance to defend himself because after he fell to the ground, they continued hitting him with kicks to the chest and head. There were 6, 7 of them, 3 or 4 hitting Ferna and a couple preventing us from getting close. The lawyer mockingly asked him how the first blow to Fernando and Philo had been. A very hard punch to the face to destabilize him and it had been sudden. The witness, assuming the role of Fernando, reconstructed, throwing himself to the courtroom floor, how his friend fell after receiving the first punch, and then what the victim did to try to evade the kicks they were giving him in the chest and face. According to the witness's statements, one of the accused rushed his friends. Now, what's happening now that we're outside? A way of starting the fight. Then, Fernando received a blow to the head from behind and fainted. A kick to the head finished him off. Tomas de Alessandro also testified. He witnessed the altercation inside the nightclub and tried to defend Fernando when they attacked him outside. He said he tried to defend him, but then they attacked him, threw him to the ground and kicked him in the body and head. When Tomas was able to get up, he saw Fernando covered in blood and unconscious. The rugby players had already left. He called 911. The 8 boys are also charged with the crime of minor injuries, for the attacks suffered by at least 5 of Fernando's friends. In addition to Tomas, those attacked were Ignacio Badania, Juan Manuel Pereira Roses, Juan Bautista Besuzzo and Lucas Vegid. During the 11th and 12th days of the trial, the parents of 6 of the defendants testified. On the first day, the day the third week of the trial began, Rosalia Cerati, Maximo's mother, and Maria Paula Sinai, Blast's mother, spoke. On the second day, Mauro Pertosi, Ciro and Luciano's father, Hector Eduardo Benizelli, Matias' father, and Maria Alejandra Gillian, Enzo's mother, spoke. Erica Pizzati, Eitan's mother, was also expected to speak. Maria Paula, Blast's mother and Ciro and Luciano Pertosi's aunt, was the first of the parents to testify. During her testimony, she described what happened to Fernando as a disaster and a great misfortune. She stated that she did not want to even think about what the parents of this boy had gone through in reference to the victim, but she immediately said that they, the rugby players' relatives, had also suffered because this misfortune was so great that it continued to affect him every day. As if that were not enough, she described the trial as a media show. Upon hearing these words, Fernando's parents, Graciela Sosa and Silvino Vaz, left the room. Rosalia Cerati, Maximo's mother and Matias' aunt, was a civil servant in the municipality of Cerati and resigned after her son was charged. During the hearing, the woman spoke about her health and her testimony caused her son to break his silence. She indicated that she is sick with cancer and that she had surgery. She received radiation and also chemotherapy. She added that she was still undergoing treatment, but she stopped in order to attend the trial. She explained that in the last 2 years, all she did was leave her house to go see her son in prison and to go to the doctor. She stated that she could not do anything but continue to cope with everything that was happening. It was too much for her. She compared it to a nightmare. Seconds later, Maximo asked to testify and did so for an hour. He apologized. It would never have occurred to me in my life to kill someone. During the second week of the trial, experts determined that the bloody shoe that left a mark on the victim's face belonged to Maximo. In his statement, the defendant acknowledged that it was his. During the beginning of Mauro Pertossi's presentation, Ciro and Luciano's father, Tomai, the defense attorney, asked the man what his son's activities were. He said that Luciano had finished high school and Ciro had started the CBC for architecture. He added that the family did not have enough money to help pay for their vacations and so his two sons did odd jobs. He explained that the young men traveled to Villagesal in the car of Maximo's father, Marcial, and in Matias's. In the middle of his statement, Pertossi broke down in tears when talking about what happened next. He said that when he thought things were going well in life, events like the one discussed in the trial happened and he did not know what to think. He stated that his children were not murderers and that he could not believe that they were being accused of such terrible charges. He said that he now had to deal with other problems, in addition to the situation he is experiencing with his children, since due to this he cannot find a job and was fired from the company where he worked after 25 years of working there. He said with pain that he started working when he was a child and that now he could not find a job and that the breadwinner of the family was his wife. He ended by saying that things were not going well and that he had received threats. After testifying, the father of the Pertossis asked to remain in the courtroom. Hector Eduardo Benesei, Matias' father, expressed that he felt a lot of pain, anguish and that he never imagined going through a situation like this, since they were harassed and could not even go out to the sidewalk. He complained about having to listen to how his wife was being insulted in the media and said that he could not find an explanation or a fair word to describe what they were experiencing. He stated that his job had declined and that the last 3 years had been very painful. He also questioned those he heard saying that they wanted their son to be hurt in prison. I don't want to say that what happened wasn't terrible. What happened is terrible. A terrible pain for everyone. Terrible, he added. Like Pertossi, Benesi asked to remain in the courtroom. Maria Alejandra Gillian, Enzo Camelli's mother, went directly to Berlanda, the lawyer for the victim's parents, who at the beginning of the trial had pointed out the defendants after supposedly seeing them laugh during the trial. What are you laughing at, sons of? He asked them at that moment. That's why Maria Alejandra's first words were that she wanted to tell the Lord, mockingly, that she was not a prostitute and that it was terrible for her and her family to hear those words. She said about her son that he worked at a nightclub and that he paid for his vacations in Villa Gesell with that, and added that what happened changed everyone's life. On January 18th, the stage for witnesses and presentations of videos, photographs and illustrations, as well as third-party allegations regarding the incident, ended. Therefore, it was decided that Wednesday, January 25th, and Thursday, January 26th, would be the dates for the main arguments of the parties. The prosecution testified on January 25, 2023. Dr. Berlanda's request was for life imprisonment for all the defendants, while the prosecution in the trial supported the request for the maximum penalty applicable in Argentina. The prosecution's argument lasted approximately 10 hours. Graciela, Fernando's mother, testified before the defense's argument and said that she never thought she would find herself in that situation. She believed that her son would one day graduate as a lawyer and see him defending people in court. She indicated that she never imagined seeing his murder as she had to during the trial. She said that as a mother, seeing him on the ground begging for mercy, she felt the need to throw herself on top of him to protect him, because she would give her life for her son, a good, decent boy who never believed in evil. She said that she took care of a lady on Saturdays and Sundays and what she earned went to fair. She said that her son was happy and she was happy for him. They spoke on the phone that night in January 2020 and Fernando told her that he loved her. While she was sleeping, confident that everything was fine, the phone rang and she ran to answer it. On the other end of the line was the mother of one of Fair's colleagues who asked her what she was doing. When Graciela answered that she was about to leave for work, the woman asked her if she knew what had happened to Fernando and informed her that he had been taken in an ambulance. Graciela said that she thought he had been in an accident. She did not know that the call the night before had been the last. Silvino also testified and said that those present in the courtroom were before a father who had lost everything, his happiness, his desire to live, to fight, and he had lost the best thing of all, which was his son's embrace. He recalled that he had serious kidney problems and on several occasions he had returned home after undergoing dialysis, ready to throw in the towel because he couldn't take it anymore. And in those days, Fernando would hang on to his neck and ask him how he was feeling and try to help him. And this guy who had come dead was more alive than ever with a hug from his son. He offered me his kidneys. I told him, "Son, I would never touch you," he said. The defense, headed by attorney Tomai, requested the acquittal of the accused on January 26th, arguing that the charges against him did not match what was alleged by the prosecution. The day before, the defense made its arguments in 2 hours. They basically insisted that there was no malice. The plan to kill could not be proven. During those 7 minutes, there was no defenselessness, although there was an assault. Tomai also requested that the seizure of the defendants' cell phones and clothing at the time of their arrest be nullified, since they were not informed of their rights. Maximo spoke in court on January 26, 2023. "I want to apologize to the families and those affected. It hurts me deeply because he is a boy our age. I wish we could turn back time." Then he cried and said that he was very sorry and that he would always abide by whatever the court decided. At the end of the defense and after granting the power to speak to the 8 defendants, Judge Castro announced that the final verdict would be given on February 6, 2023 at 1 p.m. The final sentencing began after 1 p.m. on February 6, 2023. At 1:21 p.m., Tomai requested authorization for the convicts to receive their sentences standing. The verdict was unanimously handed down to 5 of the 8 defendants, while the remaining 3 were named as secondary participants. The court, headed by Magistrates Castro, Rabaya, and Latsari, decided to sentence Maximo, Ciro, Eno, Matias, and Luciano to life imprisonment as criminally responsible co-authors. Maximo was the main suspect based on scientific evidence and witness testimony. He was also accused of being the leader of the group, and the complaint had defined him as follows. He is the leader of the pack and the general who waits for his soldiers to carry out the maneuver. Maximo Thompson and Ciro Pertosi were attacking the victim at all times, the court said, and sentenced them to life sentences, as were the other three defendants. After hearing the verdict, Maximo fainted, which caused Judge Castro to order the courtroom to be cleared for about 6 minutes. In the meantime, Ayrton, Blast, and Lucas were each sentenced to 15 years in prison as secondary participants in the crime. For their part, Fernando's parents stated that nothing could bring their son back, but that they felt justice had been done, at least partially. They did not agree with the 15-year sentences given to three of the defendants, because in their view all eight were equally responsible by action or omission. Julieta, Fernando's girlfriend, had decided to remain silent throughout the legal process. Upon learning of the sentence, he expressed himself laconically but forcefully on social media by posting a photo of the eight rugby players on Instagram with the title, Convicted. According to reports, both the defense and the prosecution will appeal the sentence. Given that the court considered the crime to be aggravated homicide due to premeditated participation and malice aforethought, Tomei had already announced that he would seek a nullity and acquittal of his clients or that they would defend their roles in a homicide in a fight or simple homicide with eventual malice aforethought. Meanwhile, mockingly, he had considered in the arguments that the eight defendants were responsible for the crime of aggravated homicide due to malice aforethought and the premeditated participation of two or more people, so it is possible to appeal the crime and the sentence attributed to the three young men considered secondary participants, with the sentences currently imposed, according to Argentine law, taking into account that the life expectancy for a man in that country is 73 years. This means that those guilty of Fernando's crime could be set free for close to the expected life expectancy. Although the maximum sentence of life imprisonment has not been established, the most widely applicable criterion in these cases considers 50 years in prison as an extreme hypothesis. In order to be eligible for parole, the five rugby players would have to serve two-thirds of that sentence, that is, 33 years, of which they have already served three. They could then be temporarily released in 2052. Meanwhile, those who were secondary participants in the same crime were sentenced to 15 years in prison, but parole could be granted after 10 years of effective service. Another aspect of the trial concerns the economic aspect. Without the ruling, the Dolores Court specified the costs that those guilty of Fernando's crime should face for the fees of the four lawyers who represented the victim's family, Fernando Berlanda, Fabian Amendola, Facundo Amendola and German Facio. In the ruling, the judges established that the families of the eight rugby players will have to jointly pay a total of 80 HUS. This is a unit of tariff measurement equivalent to 6,854 pesos to the four aforementioned lawyers. Taking into account the reference values, each rugby player should pay 584,320 pesos. However, the figure is higher due to the value-added tax, VAT, of the indicated amount, in addition to the contributions to the lawyers' pension fund, which are 10% of the net value. Therefore, the total amount that those guilty of Fernando's murder must pay amounts to 718,326. This figure would be equivalent to around $2,000, taking into account the recent value of the blue dollar or the black market in Argentina, where it is quoted at around 370 pesos per dollar. The rugby players must also pay the fees corresponding to their defense attorney Hugo Tomei. And while we are talking about him, according to reports, the parents of some of the convicted men have held meetings with other lawyers in recent days with the aim of changing the strategy. It is worth remembering that Tomai represented the group from the moment of their arrest 3 years ago. The meetings with new lawyers have reportedly taken place, since the deadline to appeal the ruling before the Buenos Aires Court of Cassation is 20 days. In the meantime, the eight convicted men arrived at Melchor Romero and a prisoner leaked the first image that was immediately released by various Argentine media outlets. The prisoner who released the image also referred to the special conditions in which those detained for Fernando's murder have been held from the very beginning. They are expected to be there for a short time, as it is a mayor's office and is a place for those who have not been sentenced. Now that they have their respective sentences, there is talk of transferring Seven to the same prison, but Máximo would go to a maximum security prison to protect him, as his life has been threatened by inmates who have promised to bring justice for Fernando in a violent manner. Fernando's parents maintained that they are already condemned to suffer eternally for the pain of losing their beloved son, but that they felt that they fought for justice for the violent snatching of Fernando's life. Their wish was that the sentences for the aggressors be exemplary so that no other young person or family has to go through such profound agony. The judge of guarantees, David Moncinehi, who started this whole case when he decided to keep the rugby players accused of killing Fernando in prison in 2020, finally made a public statement in an interview with Infobae after the defendants were sentenced. He was asked why this case affected society so much, and he replied that it was because its characteristics did not go unnoticed. The fight started for an insignificant reason. Fernando waited, eating an ice cream. The other group walked around the block. He hoped there were no police officers. He even prepared a cell phone to film the attack on a defenseless young man. On the other hand, Fernando's kindness caught society's attention. He was a loving son, a loyal companion, a faithful boyfriend, committed to social tasks. Silvino and Graciela raised a beautiful human being. The end he met was not fair. He did not deserve that torment. And people saw his children and siblings getting sick. Society no longer tolerates violence or arrogance. Fernando was embraced as a symbol of peace. And well, dear viewer, this concludes today's crime story. I would be very interested in knowing your opinion, so I ask that you leave it in the comments of the video, always with respect for the victim and her family. We can debate, but always with the respect that we all deserve. Again, I remind you to subscribe and leave a like to let me know that you like my work. Good night. Until the next crime story.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.